Hello, this is Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, and you are listening to Catholic Baltimore on Q1370 WQLL. Catholic Baltimore is a weekly radio program hosted by the Archdiocese of Baltimore, airing each Sunday following the broadcast of the Radio Mass of Baltimore. We are grateful to our Catholic radio partners for sharing with us some of the contents in this program and for the opportunity to bring quality Catholic programming to the Archdiocese of Baltimore every Sunday.
I'm Sean Kane, and you're listening to Catholic Baltimore. The unrest in Baltimore City in the spring of 2015 highlighted the need for greater opportunities for young people, especially those from disadvantaged homes. One way to provide such opportunities is through a quality education. Unfortunately, far too many families do not have good educational options for their children. That's where Catholic schools can make a difference. Graduating 99% of its students, with 98% going on to college, Catholic schools can change lives for the better. And there's an effort among many area business leaders to make these schools more affordable and accessible. Here to talk about this effort are Tom Kurowski and Matt Anthony. Gentlemen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Sean.
So the effort I'm alluding to is called Partners in Excellence, and it's an initiative that began by Cardinal Keeler. Matt, if you could give us a little bit of a history as to when that began and what the overall goal of Partners in Excellence is, and give us a little bit more details about it.
Sure. It was about 20 years ago, back in 96, when Cardinal Keeler was having conversations with local business leaders, including the likes of Chip Mason. The Cardinal noticed that a lot of our inner city schools were serving a population that was less the Catholic population that they were founded to serve, and more of a marginalized, disadvantaged, non-Catholic population. That shift in mission came along with a noticeable increase in need for these families. These families really wanted to make the choice to send their children to a Catholic school because it was a better choice in their eyes. And so the Cardinal, along with Chip Mason and other business leaders at the time, started Partners in Excellence to meet the funding gap, the gap that consists of, you know, the difference between what a family can pay and what the actual cost to educate the child is. We've been going along for about 20 years now, and our primary goal is to give opportunity to families who wouldn't have that opportunity.
So, Tom, what's your role with PI, and why did you personally get involved?
My role in PI, I'm the chairman of the Board of Advisors. I've been so for the last 3 years and have been involved overall for about five altogether. What actually drew me to this was a friend, Joe Libitor, who took me on a tour of a school along with Matt. And what's ironic is that that school was in Patterson Park. It's now called the Archbishop Borders. At that time, it was in the old Our Lady of Pompeii School and has since moved down to Sacred Heart. But what's interesting about that is that my dad grew up across the street from Patterson Park. That was his front yard. And so as a consequence, it really brought me back to seeing probably what his life was like growing up 75 years ago. It was a lot of immigrants to Baltimore, a lot of people starting out trying to make a better way. And when you look at how my dad and my mom progressed, you know, they moved from the city out to the county, raised their children, you know, big Baltimore Colts fans and the like. But as they moved out of the city, there's a new generation of people coming in, which we find downtown today, that are all trying to make a way in life and just need a little bit of help.
And ironically, the Catholic schools would have been an important part of that process for them.
They were very important. In fact, they oftentimes talk about the grounding that they got in Catholic school and what a foundation that it made for them and how important it is. But also back then, the schools were free or very inexpensive. Mm-hmm. Now they're not so.
And so can you just give a description? So how does Partners in Excellence work? What's the structure? If I'm a local businessman and I say, yeah, there's I recognize a need, and I also recognize that Catholic schools can fill that need, I want to get involved. So what's the next step?
Well, the next step is certainly we'd love to come out and chat with you, but also, too, we can assign you a student. There's a number of ways to approach it. There are those that, you know, provide money on an annual basis. That's fairly regular. What we want to do is make a promise to a student to say that once you enter our schools, we will see you through to at least eighth grade. And overall, our goal is to provide 1,000 scholarships at least per year, up to an average of $2,500, which, based on the schools that we're focused on, it's about half the tuition. Right, Matt?
Yes.
So in addition to serving a need and maybe having some sense of fulfillment or satisfaction from a business perspective, what's the benefit?
The benefit to them, and this is really one of the reasons why PI was started and why Chip Mason was involved long ago, is that he recognizes that we need to educate the next generation of workers or potential workers for Baltimore. So it really solves a couple of needs. One is that it addresses that goal. But secondly, one thing we notice is that when you solidify a school, you solidify a neighborhood, and that neighborhood becomes safer, and it draws people back into the city. So it's really, in a way, we kind of look at it as one of the ways in which Baltimore can rebuild itself.
So you mentioned you were kind of hooked when you went through the tour. Matt, you've got the happy job of being able to take these folks through the schools, and I know in your mind you have to think, if
that's
I can just get
job.
Them to one of the schools. So what is it that people say? They kind of probably come reluctantly. They're invited by a colleague or a peer. Mm-hmm. They do it for them, and then they do the tour, and then what? What do they say?
Well, you know, sometimes they'll come out into one of our schools, and it's not exactly in the best neighborhood in Baltimore, and they're they might come with some apprehension, but, you know, when they walk through the doors and there's a student or two there to greet them, they shake their hands, look them right in the eye, and say, "Welcome to Archbishop Waters School." And, you know, after an hour of being there, having a conversation with some of the students and the principal, the one thing I hear time and time again is, "Wow, I did not know this school was here. I did not know the Archdiocese was doing this. Mm-hmm. Thank you."
And we've mentioned Borders, but there are multiple schools that have what we call PI kids, you know, mm-hmm. in those schools. Numbers or descriptions or how many or do we know?
Yeah, sure. The PI program is primarily focused on six schools in Baltimore City. Four of them are our Catholic community schools located in key neighborhoods throughout the city.
When you use that term, you're basically referencing these are community-based schools. They're serving kids in and around the neighborhoods where the school's located.
Exactly. And the other two schools are the two archdiocesan high schools in the city, Seton Keogh and Archbishop Curley High School. And those six schools represent probably about 80 to 85% of the scholarships. There are probably overall about 20 schools in and around Baltimore that have PI scholars, but as I said, the majority are at those six schools. In an average year, we probably give out between 600 to 650 scholarships for an average of just under $2,000. That's the average of the past couple of years. So that means we're giving out over $1 million a year. And for these families, it's life changing. It's an opportunity that will move families out of the cycle of poverty that they've been in.
Now, I know one of the unique parts of PI is that it does require every family to make some investment, which
absolutely.
I think is a really important point. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about the idea behind that?
Well, they have skin in the game, you know. Prior to my role here with Partners in Excellence, I was a teacher in an inner city school, and I saw firsthand the effect that, you know, having skin in the game has on a family. You get parents answering your phone calls, coming in to talk to you. The kid gets a strong sense of how important this is. You know, I better not mess up because a lot of people are counting on me. And so to have a family, you know, make that stretch just to pay 25 to 50% of the tuition is really beneficial to that student.
And we're talking not just parents, but extended family,
grandparents, aunts, uncles,
godparents. It takes a village in that case.
Absolutely.
Well, it's interesting. You talk to some of the principals and they'll tell you stories that when it does take a village that they will get, you know, not only the parent paying tuition, but the aunt, the uncle, they'll come in with cash just to make that tuition payment.
Right. But because that's how important it is to them that the child continue.
Exactly.
Because they see the difference.
Right. And that was truthfully, Sean, that was one of the key things that I saw in the beginning is that we are to make sure that everybody pays something is important, because when you pay for something, it means something. And as Matt says, you have skin in the game. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is I think that's the reason why the program works. I think the reason the schools work is because the schools are safe. If you talk to Kathy Marshall at one of our schools, she'll say, "We're safe. The kids, this is one of the safe environments that these children know." And as a consequence, when children feel safe, they're generally happy. When they're happy, they will listen. And when they listen, they'll learn. And that's really the route to the success.
So what is the strategy going forward? Obviously, the more businesses who contribute, the more money you can distribute. So right. Where are you now in terms of talking to other businesses and trying to get them on board?
Well, I should say that this is not just an outreach to businesses. You know, I would say we're pretty, in terms of the contributors to PIE, we're pretty well divided between corporations, foundations, and individual donors. And as I said before, one of the things I hear a lot is, and we didn't know this was here. And what my charge is, and what Tom and the PIE board's charge is to help spread the word out in the community, let people know that these schools are there. That's the first step. If we can let them know that they're there, people who hear about it will say, well, of course I'll support that. This is a great thing.
Anything last words you want to contribute, Tom?
Well, I was just going to say also in terms of getting people to understand and learn more about PIE, we do have our annual back-to-school breakfast, which we're going to be hosting in early September down at the Marriott again this year. This will be our third annual. You'll also see us more active on social media. In fact, around their breakfast, we're going to have what's called a giving day. And we think that that's a way to reach a number of people as well. And as Matt said, and the reaction I always get when I talk to people about PIE is, this is a great program. Why have I not heard about it? Mm-hmm. So truthfully, our mission over the next year or so is to increase the awareness. So it's through events like this, and thanks for having us in today, where we can broadcast the message and get people more aware.
Excellent. Well, you can learn more about Partners in Excellence at www.archbault.org. Tom and Matt, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Sean.
You are listening to Catholic Baltimore on Q1370 WQLL.
Catholic news from the Archdiocese of Baltimore and around the world with the Catholic Review. In a July 4th Mass in Washington, D.C., to close the fourth annual Fortnight for Freedom, Archbishop Thomas Wenski of Miami, Florida, called religious freedom the human right that guarantees all other rights. In his homily at the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception, Archbishop Wenski said Jesus calls us to be always for the world, and this explains why the Church is concerned with education, health care, and civic affairs. He said the Church advocates for the poor and seeks greater economic and social justice for all. Archbishop William Lurie of Baltimore, who chairs the U.S. Bishops' Committee on Religious Liberty, can celebrate at the Mass in Washington. When do you plan to retire? One joy-filled priest in the Archdiocese is retiring from full-time ministry at the ripe age of 82. Monsignor Martin Field retired July 1st as pastor of St. Joseph in Tawnytown. He first thought of being a priest in the fourth grade. He found happiness in the priesthood and tried to share that with others. Read more about Monsignor Field's vocation advice at CatholicReview.org. Tickets are still available for the Archdiocese of Baltimore's pilgrimage to Pope Francis's outdoor Mass in Philadelphia, September 27th. Pilgrims can take a bus from one of four locations or take the train from Baltimore Penn Station. A crowd of more than 1 million people is expected for the Mass, the only one on the Pope's six-day U.S. schedule open to the general public. For details on the pilgrimage, visit francisinphilly.org. From the newsroom of the Catholic Review, this is Christopher Gunty.
Do you want to know more about what's going on in the church and the world than you can get from your daily newspaper or local TV? Read the only newspaper in the Archdiocese of Baltimore that covers the church full time, the Catholic Review. The print newspaper can be delivered to your home every other Thursday, and you can get fresh news every day online at CatholicReview.org. Subscribe to the Catholic Review e-newsletter for twice a week updates. Find our app on Apple and Android, and follow the Catholic Review on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. Wherever your faith takes you, Catholic Review Media is ready to inspire, teach, inform, and engage. Read it today, in print and online, at CatholicReview.org. Again, online, that's CatholicReview.org.
Catholic Baltimore takes a look at the men who have led the Premier See of Baltimore since its inception in 1789. With the help of Father Michael Roach, church historian and professor of church history at Mount St. Mary Seminary, we are offered a glimpse into the challenges and achievements, the education and background, and the leadership qualities of those men who have served as Archbishop of Baltimore. This is Sean Kane, and you're listening to Catholic Baltimore. Father Roach, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
We're here today to speak about the nation's first Catholic bishop, John Carroll. What should we know about John Carroll's background that would help us understand his appreciation for the Maryland tradition of American Catholicism?
Well, John Carroll was a representative of the great Anglo-Irish population in Maryland, mainly in southern Maryland in those early colonial days. His family was very prominent, great landowners. One of his cousins signed the Declaration of Independence. A brother signed the Constitution. They were very, very prominent people, very prominent people. And his family made the sacrifice of sending him off to Europe for his education. It was about quite a risk. When he was 13 years old, he left for French Flanders to go to Saint-Omer, which was a Jesuit school specifically for English-speaking colonials throughout the world, and it was a very successful school. And he and his cousin, his double cousin actually, Charles Carroll of Carrollton, took off for that school at the same time. And Charles Carroll writes back to his family that Jackie Carroll is the smartest boy in the whole school. So he was a very gifted man from the get-go.
So clearly intelligence helped him to achieve his future lot in life. What else about him made him ideal for the position?
Absolutely. He was the youngest one around, as a matter of fact. The Jesuit missionaries had gotten old, and John Carroll was one of the youngest of the lot, and so he was the logical choice when it came to selecting a candidate for the episcopacy.
So what was the environment back in the 1780s in the United States when the Vatican said, hey, maybe we should formalize a diocese there?
Yeah. Well, things had gotten much better. No one welcomed the American Revolution more than the Roman Catholics did, because it met an end to so many of the oppressive penal laws that they had to suffer through, even in relatively tolerant Maryland. So the 1780s were a great decade for American Catholicism.
How big was his job? What was the what were the biggest challenges for him in starting a new diocese in a uncharted land?
Right.
Basically?
One of the main ones, of course, was geographical. It was such a far-flung diocese, going all the way from Maine out really to the Louisiana Territory for a while. So just the very scope of the geographical responsibility. And he had very few priests and not a lot of Catholics. I think he writes to Propaganda that there are 10,000 Roman Catholics in the United States, mainly in Maryland, some in Northern Virginia, some in Pennsylvania, a few in New York. But he has almost no priests, and the priests he has are getting old, very old.
And speaking of priests, he would tap the Sulpicians to assist. In what way did he do that, and how did that relationship kind of come to be about?
That's a great story. When he was in England getting consecrated as a bishop, he got two great gifts. One, his cousin, Mother Ann Hill, writes from the lowlands that she's sending Carmelite nuns to southern Maryland, to Charles County, to found really what is the first convent in the new country. And then the Sulpicians sent a representative to him from Paris to say that they would be very interested in coming to his diocese and starting a seminary and staffing it and even bringing a few candidates with them. It was an offer he couldn't refuse.
Right. So they would go on to found and establish St. Mary's Seminary.
St. Mary's Seminary in Packer right. Street.
And he's also connected pretty closely to the early days of Georgetown University. And how did that come to
be? Oh, yes. Well, he had been a Jesuit before the Suppression, and his great passion was for education. And he writes about Georgetown, "On this academy on the Potomac, I base all my hopes for the future of the Church and the Republic." So
he was a true academe.
He really was. Yeah. That was his. And nothing gave him more comfort than seeing the educational establishments at Georgetown, at Baltimore, and later at Emmitsburg.
Is there anything we can tell from his writings or from others who wrote about him, just his style in terms of how he approached the position of Archbishop of Baltimore? I guess then there was no nuncio, so part of that role would have been to kind of be the link between Rome and the United States and the church here.
Right. His relationships with Rome, very interesting. See, he had been in Rome at the time of the suppression of the Society of Jesus, and the Jesuits suffered terribly at that time, and that always gave him a certain distance from Roman politics. He was a very loyal son of the church, of course, but he had his reservations about the way things often had worked out.
Was he, you know, in looking back, was he the right man for the job at the time, given all the challenges that were there?
No question about it. I mean, the most fortuitous choice of any Archbishop of Baltimore. John Carroll was the man for the job at that time, no question. Mm.
And in terms of what he accomplished while here, obviously starting the church was the accomplishment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were there any seminal events that stood out? I know he had one synod.
Right.
While he was here, were there any other achievements that you would look back and say that, you know, that's should be right up there with any discussion of his legacy?
Oh, yes. Well, certainly the educational establishments, the establishments of the religious orders of women in the diocese, the number of parishes increasing, and the accountability that he sought from his clergy, which was very needful because these people had been used to operating with no immediate authority over them. So he had his battles. Certainly, his challenges were unruly trustees in the parishes and also some fairly unruly clergy who'd come to Europe because they were in trouble over there, so they came to America and often brought their troubles with them.
We see when we look at the history of the church, we see references to trustees. What are historians referring to when they mention trustees?
Right. Because of the law, the church couldn't own property, so there were people who owned property in the church's name from colonial times. The problem was they weren't used to having a bishop over them. They thought they were the ultimate word in running a parish. And with a bishop here in Baltimore, that came to an end because there were checks and balances that had to be observed. The trustees, especially in the South, it seems, gave the bishops of Baltimore a hard time.
Mm-hmm. One of John Carroll's accomplishments, I guess, was also his relationship with Elizabeth Ann Seton. He invites her to the diocese. How'd that come about?
They had a very interesting relationship. I always thought it was sort of a cat and mouse relationship. There was a mutual respect there, indeed. But he would come to Emmitsburg to visit and say, you can't live like this. It's too cold. Your sisters are dying of consumption. Your students are freezing. And she'd say, oh, yes, I know. I'm a helpless woman. Nothing I can do. I'll clean it all up. We'll take care of it. He'd come back the next year, and she had done what she wanted to do, and there was not necessarily the following of all the bishop's dictums. It was a wonderful relationship. It's good to chart. It's good to read their correspondence. I'm not sure that he invited them to Baltimore. He welcomed them to Baltimore. It was actually the two priests of Boston, Matignon and Chevreux, who told her, go to Baltimore, because that's the most Catholic city in the country, and that's where you have the best chance. And that's what brought her to Baltimore in that summer.
What was Bishop Carroll's relationship like with the executive branch of the U.S. government, mm-hmm. and just in terms mm-hmm. of...
The Carrolls were so prominent that they were accepted throughout the new country. The Carrolls had a very weighty name, and so they were listened to. And there was a respect, I think, between Washington, George Washington, and John Carroll, and all of Washington's successors.
And do you think he, because of that respect, that he helped to assuage whatever skepticism there might have been towards a Roman church?
Yeah, the really vicious anti-Catholicism doesn't begin until about 1829. So there were so few Catholics in the United States in those early days that they didn't really pose a threat to many people. So there was a bit of an incipient anti-Catholicism, but never as strong as it would be in the nativist period of the middle third of the 19th century.
So the closing word on John Carroll's legacy would be?
True greatness. And if you want to see that in chapter and verse, read his sermon upon taking possession of his cathedral in Baltimore.
That's Father Michael Roach on the history and legacy of John Carroll, the first bishop of Baltimore.
Are you interested in joining the Archdiocese of Baltimore and Catholic Review Media on a bus pilgrimage to the Papal Mass in Philadelphia, September 27th? Pope Francis is expected to celebrate an outdoor mass along Philadelphia's famed Benjamin Franklin Parkway. It will be a huge crowd and a great way to celebrate our faith together with hundreds of thousands of fellow Catholics. Even if the Pope is just a tiny dot from your vantage point, or you can only see him on a video screen, you will want to join what will probably be the largest gathering of Catholics in the USA this year. For more information about the September 27th pilgrimage to the Papal Mass, visit tinyurl.com/CR-Philly Bus. That's tinyurl.com/CR-Philly Bus or call 443-524-3150, 443-524-3150. See you in Philly.
For 143 years, New Cathedral Cemetery has served the needs of the Catholic community of Baltimore and Central Maryland. New Cathedral is the only cemetery owned by the Archdiocese of Baltimore and is the final resting place for many religious orders and famous citizens. 125 acres of rolling hills, trees, and beautiful monuments, the cemetery is an oasis of peace and tranquility and is located off Edmondson Avenue just outside of Catonsville. New Cathedral is dedicated to the task of tending to the mortal remains of our dearly departed and has many more years of available space. If you are in need of a burial site, vault, monument, or marker, or just a respectful location to place your cremated loved ones, our counselors will help you through this process and make sure the wishes of you and your loved ones are honored. Visit us online at newcathedralcemetery.org, like us on Facebook at New Cathedral Cemetery Bonnie Bray, or call 410-566-7770.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of Catholic Baltimore. As we prepare for the week ahead, let us do so in prayer together as one community of faith. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Let us also ask the blessing and intercession of our Blessed Mother as we pray. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen. May God bless us and keep us always in his love.